This is the second in a two-part series on something called Bacon's Castle. So if you're listening to podcasts, stop, go back, listen to the first one first, and then come in on this one. But if you're listening on the radio, here's a brief recap. Bacon's Castle is a place in Virginia. It was a prominent part of something called Bacon's Rebellion, which happened in the late 1600s. Yeah, you heard me right. That overlooked century that we sort of ignore prior to our revolution. Well, Bacon's Rebellion's important. It's something you really shouldn't ignore, and we've been talking about Bacon's Castle. We've been talking about Bacon's Rebellion with a couple of fine ladies from an organization called Preservation Virginia, which runs Bacon's Castle, which is this year celebrating its 350th anniversary. You heard me right, 350 years. We are older than just 200 years. It's 350. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Bacon's Castle.
Your weekly constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
Last week, I played a really dirty trick on you. I did something we rarely do on this show, and we had a genuine cliffhanger. We'd literally taken you to the point where 400 armed men were approaching Jamestown, led by a fellow named Nathaniel Bacon, who was in the midst of leading a rebellion against the English governor. His name was Barclay, and Bacon and Barclay were confronting each other in Jamestown, and at a certain point, Barclay just opened his coat and said, "Go ahead and shoot me if you must, Nathaniel Bacon," and then we cut out on you, and I promised you we would tell you what happened next. But let me give you a little bit more context in case you're just joining us for the first time. Bacon's Rebellion was about 100 years before our American Revolution. It involved a fellow named Bacon who was leading a rebellion, and the rebellion was sparked by differences in how to deal with the Native American tribes nearby. It was also fueled by differences in policy between this fellow Nathaniel Bacon and the governor Barclay, and conflicts between the ruling class in Virginia and the planter class and the indentured servants and the slaves. It was all a big mess, and it was all coming to a head in Jamestown just as we left off last time. So let's rejoin our drama, just as Governor Barclay is about to open his jacket.
In June, he gathers about 400 men, I think, thereabouts, to reapproach the governor. And they have a meeting outside.
Wait a minute. You're going to go talk to the governor with 400 men. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is not a talk, though.
No.
Okay.
It's more like a force measure.
Okay.
All right. It's basically arguing again for the commission. And this also, when he fled from the assembly, Governor Barclay basically is calling him a traitor, and he's going to hold him accountable for treason. So Bacon's gone to renegotiate terms, if you will, with support.
Yeah, 400 bayonets.
Yeah,
and at least, huh?
Finally, in front of the state house, Barclay is unwilling to change his stance, even with those men behind Bacon. Barclay turns to Bacon, draws open his coat, and offers Bacon a cheap shot.
Seriously,
saying,
so Bacon's standing there with people pointing guns at him, and he says, Okay,
I'm not going to change,
No, Barclay.
Barclay.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Bacon is threatening Barclay.
Bacon, yeah,
and
exactly.
Barclay, instead of running away or receding, simply opens his coat and says, "Okay, go ahead, shoot me."
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm respecting Barclay a bit more. He's got some guts here.
Bacon and his men don't take Barclay up on his offer. Instead, they retreat, but one council member finally concedes to Bacon, and essentially Bacon is given the commission that he wants by force. Also, he's no longer considered a traitor for the short time of this month, but
Bacon, it's a short time.
There's a lot of back and forth in this, which we do see. It's kind of interesting, the power struggles in the play here, because Barclay catches wind that there's more, I guess, turmoil now, this time in the New Kent, Gloucester area. And so he sends Bacon off on, an expedition against some of the Virginia Indians that way. And it's a complete disaster. It's a complete failure on the part of Bacon, because what he ends up doing is angering the colonists or the residents of the Gloucester area. And so at this point, Barclay uses that to his advantage and once again calls Bacon a rebel. and so you do have a lot of back and forth between...
I don't want to sound too bloodthirsty here, but at some point, if Barclay had just hung Bacon...
You know?
Well, you know, they give him a trial, but I mean, I think it sounds to me like they had lots of evidence.
It seems like
he was a traitor. He was raising militias without official sanction of the government.
Exactly.
I think he probably could have been hung, and then things would have been different.
Maybe it was his wife. Maybe it was Governor Barclay's wife saying, this is my relative. He can't do that.
Well,
of course, I'd forgotten also, that connection. Right.
At this point, it seems like he is, when you know, you go back and you look at the events from January on, it seems like he is just really non-confrontational. Governor Barclay is really not taking a stance in any of these, you know, efforts. I mean, he's calling Bacon a rebel, but, you know, it would seem that he could put out the movement early on, and he just...
Well, this would really... There are different sorts of courage, right? And this guy clearly had some physical courage, right? He was willing to have his chest shot. That would be bad. It would be uncomfortable. But he didn't apparently have the guts to just dispatch Bacon one way or the other.
I don't know if it was the guts. I don't know if Jen was saying, you know, he's philosophical at this point. I don't... Maybe he's... Because he knows that he's, you know, he's lost some of the support from the colonists. And so in many ways, it seems like he's trying to keep the peace as well. But, you know, and put it out with as little effort as possible. But anyway, going back forward, or jumping ahead in time, I guess. So we're now at the end of June into July, and at this point, Bacon and a group of men gather around the Middle Plantation, and they draw up the Declaration of Peoples, which basically says they're going to take out Barclay and then go after Virginia Indians as well.
The Declaration of Peoples.
Yes.
Now, the title sounds really grand.
It does.
And then the contents are, we're going to take out Barclay, and then we're taking out the Indians.
I mean, now don't quote me on that.
Okay.
That's not what they said. Okay. I'm bringing it to modern lingo.
That's all right, but I mean, but that's the essence
but
of it.
But that's the essence of it.
Okay, this is not sounding too noble.
And so Barclay decides to just go ahead and flee Jamestown. And at this point, Bacon and his men come back. Now, in doing so, in August, they target 19 of the landed gentry's homes.
Bacon?
Including Green Springs, they take that as well. I mean, basically, Barclay and his elite circle of friends decide that they're going to flee to the Eastern Shore, and just, yeah, they sent Barclay...
So Bacon is just going to their houses one by one and showing up and taking...
Well, I should go back in time and provide a little more context on this. So, in that period that Bacon is forcing Barclay to write a letter to the English... praising Bacon. So he writes one letter praising Bacon, and then he writes another letter stating the truth, basically, to the English. Like, you know, and so he and his men flee to the Eastern Shore and basically are waiting, I think, for the help, the intervention from the British to come in.
Which will take months.
Which, exactly. So at this point, many of the landed gentry, you know, well, many, I should say not that many considering the population size, 39 of the governor's closest friends went off with Barclay, including Allen. So that's how we bring Bacon's Rebellion to Bacon's Castle, essentially, a little bit later.
So this was actually Allen's house, and he was on the governor's side.
He was very close.
So Bacon stole this place.
Well, yeah, for a brief period, I guess you could say. Going back, in August, like I said, they had targeted some of the landed gentry homes, more on the Jamestown side. And at this point, they've also kidnapped landed gentry's wives, and they're using them as barricades while they're building forts.
Jeez Louise!
Miss Dawn Page.
terrible.
Miss Bray and some of the other landed gentry wives are being used by Miss Boyne. I shouldn't laugh about it. That wouldn't have been a happy matter. But anyway.
It wasn't happy, but it is absolutely remarkable. And I have to point out at this point, since there was no United States yet, we can't claim him. I'm not going to claim this guy as an American. He was still a British subject.
Oh, yeah.
So he's a British bad guy. Okay, I just wanted to clarify that. Okay.
Well, you know, and I think about
I'm
like...
I'm not liking this guy at all.
The uncertainty, if you were a landed gentry or landed gentry's wife in that period, of just kind of knowing how in the world is this going to turn out. I mean, total anarchy in a way. Like, you know, are we... what's going to happen afterwards? But anyway,
So
at this point,
did he ever resort to cannibalism? No, there's no evidence of that.
I don't think so.
There's not much left that this guy didn't do.
I think that's earlier in Jamestown during the starvation period. Correct?
Okay, that's another one. All right.
Yeah, we're not gonna, but no. And so, anyway, he targets Arthur Allen's home as well, and it's 70 of Bacon's men under Captain William Rookings who end up taking Bacon's castle, or as it was known, Arthur Allen's brick house, in September of 1676. And Allen has caught wind that the men are coming. So he, you know, he hides all of his valuables. He buried his valuables on site, and he fled to the eastern shore with the governor. Allen is the only member of the Surrey council to vote against sending provisions to Bacon. So Allen is somewhat outnumbered here in Surrey, and he's aware of that. So he fled. And so, you know, you could say they stole the property, though really what they did is they occupied it and they looted it. Mm-hmm. All of Allen's belongings that they could. They went through his wine, smashed bottles, killed his livestock, and plundered his tobacco crop. Mm. But, you know, it's funny because we're called Bacon's Castle. It's often thought that, you know, Bacon lived here.
Yeah.
Bacon fought here. You know, we don't actually have the documented evidence to support that Nathaniel Bacon was ever present on site.
For heaven's sake.
So
Bacon's castle was someplace that Bacon's men took from another guy. Maybe we call it that because this was such a grand house.
Well, I'll go further into that, and I'll let Jen do it. I've talked for a while.
Okay, Jen, you want to jump in here? No?
Oh, well,
no?
Well, let me finish out the story, and then I'll go into the significance of the name. Please. So, placing us into the events of September, well, even though we can't say that Bacon was ever here, we know that some of his men were present. Some of the men that were present here were also present for the burning of Jamestown.
What?
Yes.
What? They burned Jamestown.
So in September, Bacon and his men...
No one in this room is as shocked as I am by this. Okay, you know this story better than I do. Okay, they're burning down the capital city.
Well, there's a lot of back and forth over Jamestown between Bacon and Barclay. Earlier in this summer, Bacon's attention after, you know... Barclay has fled. He turns his attention towards Virginia Indian skirmish further west. And at this point, he sends some of his men, basically, once again, to punish, for lack of a better term here, the tribes, including the Pamunkey tribe. And at this point, the Pamunkey chief, who was at that assembly, is captured.
The woman.
So this was in September of 1676. The landed gentry are now aware that Bacon's men have fled, and Jamestown is somewhat open. So actually, Arthur Allen, believe it or not, went after one of Bacon's ships, but is unsuccessful. And once again, the English Barclay retreats. Bacon and his men then decide to burn the entire town of Jamestown. All that remains is one tavern, which, of course, the tavern owner was a friend of Bacon's, so makes sense. It's still there. But
Bacon saved his friend's tavern.
Saved his friend, all except for the friend's tavern. They burned down the whole town. And interestingly enough, it's subsequent burnings of Jamestown that really finally led to the relocation of the capital from Jamestown, to Williamsburg in 1699. Later,
they decide they're going
to
build out a brick this time. We're just tired of people burning down our wood house.
Well, you know, it's actually it was brick earlier
it was
in, 16,
brick.
In the early 1660s is when the
Which
legislation
is too vulnerable, though. Is that
orders.
What they thought? Because it was right on the river.
Vulnerable, and it had been, you know, attacked several times. So.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Joanna Braswell and Jennifer Hurst Wender, two ladies from the Preservation Virginia organization, which runs a place called Bacon's Castle, which we're touring today as we learn about something called Bacon's Rebellion. And if you've never heard of it, don't feel bad. It all happened about 300 years ago. After the break, we'll have a vintage quiz, another vintage quiz featuring the quiz lady. We miss her so much. And then we'll come back and we'll speak more to Jen and Joanna about Bacon's Rebellion and Bacon's Castle. Stick around.
Gathered in a conclave. The torches are lit. The shadows are flickering. It's midnight. And the constitutional quiz is ready to go. Kelly Carmichael, the quiz lady, all the way from Montpelier. Are you there?
I am here at midnight and the candles are flickering.
The candles are flickering in the mansion. We have a contestant with us. Mr. Contestant, please introduce yourself and tell us where you're from.
My name's Brooke Howard. I'm from Warrenton, Virginia.
Brooke, are you brave?
I think so.
Can you withstand the pressure?
I hope. I don't know. We'll see.
Shall I turn you over to the tender mercies of the quiz lady now?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, Kelly, let's do it.
All right, Brooke, I have a question for you. Stuart, are we allowed to give our friends a constitution to help them out a little bit? Or should we really, really test their knowledge of amendments in the Constitution today?
We definitely can do that. And in fact, we're bringing in a constitution right now, and our contestant now has it in front of him.
Good. I always feel better when someone has a constitution in their hands.
All right. As do I.
All right. All right, Brooke, here we go. Which of the following amendment groups match their listed descriptions? Which of the following amendments? So we're talking about amendments in the Constitution, amendments 1 to 27 in the Constitution, match the description. And here are the descriptions. A, amendments 1 to 2 were ratified soon after the Civil War. B, amendments 5, 15, and 20 all overturned Supreme Court decisions. C, amendments 13 to 15 were ratified soon after the Constitution was ratified. Or D, amendments 15, 19, 24, and 26 all expanded voting rights.
And that's an easy question, Kelly?
Oh, I wasn't going to say it was easy. That's why I was saying this is an open book quiz.
All right, we'll have to go over these again. Okay, so the first group of them, and we're trying to figure out whether these are accurate descriptions of these amendments, right?
Yes, accurate descriptions of the amendments. So again, is it accurate to say A, amendments 1 to 10 were ratified soon after the Civil War?
Okay, let's stop there. We'll do them one at a time so we can keep them straight. Is that accurate to say the first 10 amendments were ratified right after the Civil War?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
We can cut A.
So we're going to cut A.
Cut A.
Why are we cutting A?
I just have the dates right in front of me.
That's right. That's true. I did give you the open book access.
You gave me the book.
Okay, you gave him the book. You can't take the book now.
No, this is true.
I think maybe gave him an unfair advantage, but all right, go on. What's B again?
B, amendments 5, 15, and 20 all overturned Supreme Court decisions.
5, 15, and 20 all overturned Supreme Court decisions. Well, that takes a little bit of thought. Now, 5 is well known as, you know, the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination, compensation for taking of property. I think double jeopardy's in there as well. 15 is voting rights. What was the other one?
20.
20.
Here's why I'm going to...
Well, what's 20 before you go on with your answer?
20 is Section 1, the terms of the president and vice president shall end at noon on the 20th day.
Right, that was when they shifted the inauguration from March to January. Okay, so those are those three amendments, 5, 15, and 20. Did they all overturn Supreme Court precedents?
My reasoning on that would be that the 20th Amendment seems procedural to me.
Okay.
And I don't think the Supreme Court, as the judicial branch, can weigh in on the procedure of the executive branch, which would be the...
Yeah, it doesn't seem likely that the Supreme Court would have said that March or January was the appropriate date to inaugurate the president. And I might just add in there, I guess I'm helping you out here, but I would add in there that the Fifth Amendment was adopted so soon after the Constitution was itself adopted, that it's unlikely that that would have overturned a Supreme Court decision.
Yes.
So you're probably right on B as well. Okay. What about C?
Two to go.
All right, here we go. C, Amendments 13 to 15 were ratified soon after the Constitution was ratified.
Again, I'm going to go with D as my final answer.
Yeah, 13, 14, and 15, as the pocket Constitution here indicates, are often called the Civil War Amendments or the Reconstruction.
Yes.
Right, so they were in the 18th.
This would have been the right answer for A.
Yeah, it would have been the right answer A, and the same thing for A being the same for C, 13, 14, 15, right after the Civil War.
Well, just for completeness' sake, what is answer choice D?
Sure. Expanding voting rights, D, and congratulations, Brooke. You are now a proud owner of your weekly constitutional T-shirt and a constitution. Amendments 15, 19, 24, and 26 expand voting rights.
Okay, well, let's go through that just for the benefit of our audience. 15 was, in fact, voting rights for ex-slaves.
And then 19 was for women.
Right, was women's suffrage. What were the others?
24.
24 was, I think, expanding the vote to 18-year-olds, wasn't it?
I'm looking for my friend who has the open book test.
No, maybe that was earlier. 24 does what?
I'll go ahead and read the section for all the listeners. Yeah, the right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election president or vice president.
Yeah, that's the primary. That's the one I always forget about. And what was the last one mentioned in D?
26.
26. I think that was 18-year-olds voting.
Yes.
Yes.
Right,
yes,
okay. So they all did expand voting rights. So, okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it. And you get a T-shirt.
I appreciate the book. Constitution helped a lot on that one.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks, Kelly.
All right, no problem.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Wasn't that a great vintage quiz from the quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael? We certainly miss her so much. Right now, we're talking to two other ladies, two very knowledgeable women called Joanna and Jen from a place called Preservation, Virginia. And they're telling us about Bacon's Rebellion and a particular place, Bacon's Castle. And it turns out that this fellow named Bacon led a rebellion which actually resulted in the burning of the colonial capital of Virginia, Jamestown, and a number of other small battles and skirmishes that continued on for some period of time. I mean, this was a legitimate rebellion. You may never have heard of it, but Bacon's Rebellion, it was really a thing.
Then most of the skirmishes after that point end up near the eastern shore and the Gloucester area, where Barclay's camp is. And Bacon falls ill near the Gloucester area in October. Well, some accounts say October, some say later that fall. But and he died. But nobody really knows where he's buried because, of course, if your leader dies midway through a rebellion, you're not going to make it widespreadly known that he's gone or where he's buried.
Oh, right, of course. Right.
So,
also, tell him what Barclay was going to do to his body.
Yeah, there was some fear that Barclay was going to have him, dug up and hung, drawn, and quartered, basically the way that, any traitor would be after.
Well, that is a little bit morbid and a little bit extreme, but
you know what?
This guy kind of deserved it.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy kind of deserved it.
It's not only Bacon that they're need to do this, but anyway, so because of that, we don't really have documented evidence to where he's buried today. So it's possible that he's on site in one form or another, but probably not, since he died in the Gloucesters, I typically say. You know, and there continue to be some skirmishes in that Gloucester area. Arthur Allen had actually rose to the ranks of a Navy captain, yeah. And by this point, the British yeah, by this point, the British have arrived. And so Allen's helping them along the Gloucester area, and his friends so honored him that they ended up calling him Major. So sometimes we refer to him as Major Arthur Allen here. But it's not until December that the British aboard the Young Prince make their way up the James to regain possession of Allen's house, and of course,
so then Allen retakes what's now known as Bacon Castle.
So Allen comes back, finds that they've looted all of his belongings, sues the surviving rebels for the tobacco damages, and he prospered here pretty well after that event. It's really in January that the last of Bacon's men have surrendered.
1677. Okay.
And then
what happens?
One thing that I find, well, 26 were hung. Mm-hmm. Some died before execution. You know, they were sentenced, but they died before they were actually executed. But 26 were hung, and this was not something that was sanctioned by King Charles II. He had written Berkeley and said, you know, punish Bacon, but he was going to pardon the rest of the rebels.
Right.
And Berkeley, acting outside of the king's orders,
finally said, you know, I am really tired of this.
But so, you know, by this point, spring of 1677, and Berkeley's very old. He's now acting outside of King's orders. They're not too happy with him. He couldn't just end the movement on his own sooner. So basically steps down. And moves back to England and dies then later. But
Bacon ends up dead, and Berkeley ends up fired. And I'm thinking those are pretty good solutions for both those two guys. I mean, come on. Your whole colony's in rebellion. Your capital city's been burned down. Yeah, I say you screwed up. we need a new governor.
You know, well, what is interesting to me is I guess it wasn't a full year, considering the events between Bacon and Berkeley really kick off more in the summer of 1676. But, you know, even though there were some skirmishes, it was nothing, you know, it wasn't on the same level as 100 years later with the American Rebellion. I mean, you don't see in a complete organized event
in the fighting.
One place. It almost is like between two men.
Well, that's the scale of the era. But this was the oldest, most established, richest of all the British North American colonies.
Really, and I shouldn't under, because it was the largest uprising to this point. I mean, there's anywhere between 1,000 to 2,400 men who were reported in support of Bacon.
Yeah.
And I should say that when Bacon returns to Jamestown, on his march to Jamestown before the burning, he is calling for anybody to support him, including indentured servants, African Americans, Virginia Indian tribe. You know, he's getting support from as many people as he can.
Isn't it?
And he also is promising, you know, the slaves and indentured servants their freedom after this event that they otherwise weren't being granted. I mean, when we look at indentured servants, or from a textbook perspective, generally you think, okay, they served on site 5 to 7 years and they would acquire their freedom. But in many cases, this wasn't actually so. They either did not live to see the day that they would acquire their freedom, or the landed gentry really didn't see the way through that contract.
Right, they would tack on. It was pretty common practice to tack on additional years,
you know,
basically credit that was being given, that sort of thing. So it's true. When Bacon was marching, he did end up attracting a lot of people who were currently enslaved and still serving out their indenture to also serve him.
And the first families and the other ruling elite did not like to see the rabble being roused. Now,
right.
Did they?
Right. No, I mean, because they're aware that they're a small few of the population compared to the larger former indentured servants, slave population, and these newcomers from England, who, if they're not happy you know, with the government, I mean, that's a really large faction against the few elite, basically. Right. And so moving forward is really, from Bacon's Rebellion, you do start to see laws enacted
through the House of Burgess.
Through the House of Burgess. Between 1690 and 1700, you know, really codifying the institution of race-based slavery that we came to know. You do see the decline of indentured servitude and the rise of slavery, because at this point it is more lucrative to have a permanent servant on site for them. They are concerned that, you know, if the servants did acquire their freedom, that they would come back again, you know.
And they don't want white poor people and black poor people making common cause.
No, right.
And In fact, I think it's one of the essential aspects of slavery that's often overlooked is that if you fast forward 100 years to when the Civil War, you know, even further, actually, a couple hundred years to the Civil War, white people, poor white people in the South had nothing to gain and everything to lose by slavery. Mm-hmm. And yet they've been effectively separated from the slave population through the institution of racism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a stupid idea, racism is, mm-hmm. but if you can convince a poor white person that he's got more to
that
fear
he's got
from
more
a poor
fear.
Black person,
exactly. mm-hmm.
then that they've got something in common, that maybe they want some rearrangement of the economic circumstance, that's a very effective way to divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds to me like Bacon's Rebellion might have been one of the first times that the ruling elite decided they were going to divide and conquer.
Right. And you really hit the nail on the head with the fact that, I mean, we're dealing with thousands of people that have now coalesced against 39 people who were the richest elite that were able to flee to the Eastern Shore. When you're talking less than 100 versus thousands of people that are angry and marching towards you, it's you want to make sure that everybody has a place and that it's almost a development of a caste system, really.
Yeah.
Well, so Bacon was dangerous not just because he was a rogue and a scoundrel and was doing all these nasty things. He was dangerous because he was awakening all the rabble.
Uh-huh, right.
And all the, yeah, wow, this is enormous significance, isn't
but
it?
But when you look at it, too, there are a lot of parallels to draw. I mean, it is very different. Bacon is not trying to say we should secede from England.
Right, secede from the crown.
But the idea that the crown does not know what we're going through, or the rich elite do not know what the common man is going through and are not on our side. You know, there is that exact
This was a populist revolt.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, when you think about the conditions at that time, if you're a former indentured servant trying to make it's not the American dream type setting for these former indentured servants, because you don't have land available to you. And even then, if you're going to farm tobacco prices were not great. They're being controlled essentially by that upper merchant class,
right,
which included Allen and, you know, the English.
Stacked against you.
And so that with you're not being protected on the wilderness front from, you know, tribal attacks. So,
and here's Arthur Allen II strolling around in his pleasure garden.
Yeah.
Let us now refocus. We've got the greatest, and thank you very much, Joanna, and both of you, Jen, for that wonderful history lesson. Now we know why this is significant, and here we stand in this 1665 structure, and I'm looking at exposed beams, and I'm looking at a great big open hearth fireplace, and I'm standing in a room that you all have refurnished. So who wants to tell me about this?
I guess I will.
Okay.
So this room, Bacon's Castle, is the original structure is 5,300 square feet. The addition makes it 9,300 square feet. And in the entire structure, we really have two rooms that have been furnished to be period appropriate. And so the room that we're standing in right now, it was furnished based on a 1711 probate inventory upon the death of our Arthur Allen II.
Okay.
So this is what his bedchamber looked like when he was in here. So being 350 years old, Bacon's Castle has gone through a lot of hands. It's gone through a lot of remodels. So in this particular room, we've taken it back to the original exposed beams. We've reinstalled casemate windows, which open more like shutters than a sash window, which opens up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeological evidence has shown that the original windows had these diamond pane cut leaded glass windows.
They're opaque.
Well, they're only opaque because we didn't remove the 19th century sash windows.
Oh, okay. So, all right. Well, now I take that back. They weren't opaque in the day. All right.
When you look outside, you see the 19th century.
Right.
Now I see.
But some of the other things about this room is there is an enormous hearth, and if you were here to look at this, you would see that you could pretty much stand in it, or you could lay down in it because it's just that big.
Well, the three of us are all kind of short, so yeah, we probably could stand in there. We could.
Right. And so this was the original size. And going back to the idea of this being a Jacobean house, you're not talking, you're talking almost a medieval style.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. When you come, especially the furniture and the curlicues and the window, the shape of the windows, all of the stuff, I'm thinking I'm going back into, you know, lords and ladies. And
very much
so. You do see that medieval and even Gothic, too, some references, because the shape of the house, I'm going outside of the room, I'm sorry, Jen, but the shape of the house, if you were to look at it from a bird's eye view, it's a cross, it's a crucifix.
Okay. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're at a place called Bacon's Castle, which figured prominently in something called Bacon's Rebellion, which happened about 100 years before our revolution. And we've been talking about Bacon himself. We've been talking about this rebellion. Now we're talking about the castle itself. We're talking about this big English manor house, which figured so prominently in that rebellion. And we're going from room to room and touring with Jen and Joanna from Preservation, Virginia. After the break, we'll finish our tour of Bacon's Castle with Jennifer Hurst-Wender and Joanna Braswell. Stay with us. And now it's time to finish our interview with Jennifer Hurst-Wender and Joanna Braswell of Preservation, Virginia, who are telling us all about Bacon's Castle.
Well, let's take you into...
Well, before we go here, let's just paint more of a picture. I'm looking at you have the whitewashed walls, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got the bed in the corner, and it's got the complete curtains all the way around that. I don't know the proper word for that. Bed curtains, I guess. Bed hangings. I see something on the bed there. What is that?
It's a rope tool. Turner, right? It's
a robe?
A rope bed.
Rope turner. Oh, it's a rope bed. Okay, instead of having a box springs. Okay, that's cool. And then, of course, that huge hearth over there, which you could cook over. And in fact, I think those are cooking implements, aren't they? In the middle or the andirons? Okay. And then you've got this really old. Is that an actual old period piece?
It is. Everything in this room.
Yeah, that is actually, except for the Spanish book here. That is like the old. I think it's turn of the 16. The linen fold?
I think it's 1880s. We can look it up.
We'll look it up. It's an old piece of furniture, and that's a great big, it looks like a huge chest, okay? Mm-hmm. And then what really did strike me as I came in was that you've got these, what at first are fairly simple wooden chairs, but they have these cushions on them with the pom-poms on the corners, which make it look kind of fancy. And then, of course, it's very, very heavily carved. Now, were those original to the house or?
Well, nothing in this room is actually technically original. It's all based on a probate inventory. So we know that there were this many chairs and this table and these set of pewter plates. There was a blanket chest, that, et cetera, et cetera. So stylistically, the pieces that are in here are representative of English pieces that match the description in the probate inventory.
Okay.
That being said, the one piece that isn't part of the probate inventory that is in this room, there is a cradle in here.
I noticed that.
We technically call this our only Allen piece in the house. And the reason that we say that is because when it finally left the Allen family in the 1840s, this was in the attic. Technically, it belonged to the Allens.
I guess. But we don't know exactly how long they had it.
No. No, we don't really know anything else about it other than that.
something else?
Over here. I mean, this is just a fun piece. This is actually from 1780, and I wish you had a camera. I'm sorry, but it's a small pewter bottle, and the opening is very, very tight. I mean, what would you say, Jen, measurement-wise? We're talking...
like 2 millimeters.
Maybe. 2 millimeters, and that's how they would control the flow. But this is actually a nursing bottle. From 1780.
A nursing bottle? Right.
And when you consider the pewter in this, as well as the pewter in the chargers, I mean, you know, consider our concern over BPAs today with our bottles.
Oh, yes, of course.
And we know the pewter contained traces of lead, so here they were possibly, you know, consuming lead.
Well, it's funny you should mention, I do have a camera.
If you don't have a flash on that?
No flash. Okay, good. All right. Oh, was that illegal?
You just got to protect.
Oh, okay. I didn't know flashes will actually damage things. Oh, okay. All right.
But anyway, it's, of course, like I said, it's 1780, so it's a little bit later, but I just find it fascinating.
Very interesting. Okay. Well, now I think we've got a picture of this room.
All right. So we're going to go into the, over the porch tower here. So as Joanna mentioned, this house is built on a cruciform plan. And so you basically have two large bays on the first floor, two large bays on the second floor. The front is a tower. The bottom would have been a porch to enter. And then directly back would have been the stair tower. So unlike your modern southern houses of the 18th century, where you have this grand staircase and a central passage, this house, you open up into a great hall, and then there's actually a door separating the rest of the house from the stairs. So it's very different than what you would typically see. Now, this room, I love it because during the probate inventory, we know that there were the sleeping mats in here. So there were bedrolls.
Bedrolls in here?
Right. The idea being that there are no extant slave quarters here, so you would have your enslaved people as well as your indentured servants that would sleep in the house. It's not until several decades later that you start to get external slave quarters. But from this room, we were mentioning this house being high Jacobean architectural style. Some of the elements of that, you can see out of the window in the porch tower, you can see there are three chimneys and they're turned so that they're on a diagonal.
Yeah.
And next to those, kind of outlining the edge of the house, are Flemish gables, and they're kind of demi-lune and triangular outcroppings. And these are very typical of Jacobean style. And if you were to go to Droitwich, England, you would see an extraordinarily high concentration of these houses.
And wow. Okay.
Droitwich, England is where.
What part of England is that in? Where is it?
It's the southern, southwestern, I think, portion.
Yeah,
near Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so this is where Arthur Allen grew up. And so these are the great houses that he saw when he was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So when he's building his house here in Virginia, he's copying what he saw the elite of his town building.
Okay.
There's also some idea. Remember when we mentioned that Jamestown had a lot of brick buildings?
Mm-hmm.
There's also a pretty strong possibility that the state house in Jamestown looked very similar to this house, just multiple bays of this house.
Hmm.
Yeah. So.
Before Bacon burned it.
Right.
Okay.
So that's what I kind of wanted to show you.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going back to the story of Bacon's Rebellion, because you mentioned the brick houses in Jamestown, a series of brick row houses had just been built. And you can imagine these planters who are coming up, who have to, you know, they're raising taxes once again on these planters. And here they are building nice architecture in Jamestown, row houses, pretty high end at that point.
And Bacon burns it.
You can imagine the grudges that they must have held sailing up in James.
I think they should have hung another 23. Okay.
So we'll go up to the garret space real quick.
This is that back area you talked about, and it really is just a little square with turned staircases.
Yeah, watch your step here, because
right.
It's very narrow.
Okay. Oh, we really are up in a garret. This is,
right.
The tilted ceiling, the exposed beams, everything. Yeah, even the roofing nails poking through.
Exactly. And we love the roofing nails because you can see rose head and machine cut and wire nails. So it takes you through...
All periods.
Yes.
Now, that's spoken like true architectural historians. To me, they look like nails.
Well,
And I'm thinking, I don't want to run into any of them.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we always tell our visitors, don't lean back.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I had a really interesting interview some time ago with a woman who'd written about Thanksgiving up in New England. Mm-hmm. And she is a historian, I mean, a real historian. And she pointed out that there were two very different societies. New England society was fundamentally different. They showed up with their plows and their implements. They were ready to work.
Right.
They expected to work. These guys showed up and, where's my servants?
Exactly.
Where are my servants? Okay. So those are differences that persist to this day in many regards. But to get back to where we are in mm-hmm. the garret, what really strikes me here is that when I compare this, for example, with some of the other grand houses of Virginia, this is clearly much older. Mm-hmm. When you walk up to the front of this house, you've got that sense of it's sort of crumbling a little bit.
Hey, now.
No. I'm not being, it's just older. It's got an extra 100 years or so on it, right? Okay, so it's a patina.
Exactly.
It's a patina. Of course it is. No. All right, it's older. And of course, it's an earlier period. The wealth had not accumulated to the extent mm-hmm. it did 100 years later, maybe when George Mason built Gunston Hall.
Right.
Or Mount Vernon,
right.
or Monticello, or Madison's House, Montpelier. Those are really and truly grand houses. Mm-hmm. Even today, you know, if you could add a couple of bathrooms and central air conditioning, you could see yourself living in Montpelier very grandly. You look at this, and it has a much more rough-hewn aspect to it. I mean, you've got the rough-hewn floor planks. You've got it looks like they're living... rough.
Well, compared. Certainly indentured servants up in the garret would
sure.
be.
This but is even, but even the bedroom insight. Downstairs. Seriously, even the bedroom I was in there. And I'm not being critical. I'm simply saying it was an earlier period. It they had not accumulated the wealth they had 100 years later.
Well, and like I mentioned, it's also in almost a medieval hall style.
Yeah. So it
that,
is.
That
yes.
is a very, very... I want to say it's masculine. You know, it doesn't have the
ladies' touch.
Well, it doesn't have some of the things that make it
you can just see
hospitable.
Men clumping around, burping and scratching and just, you know, doing all sorts of objectionable things. Yeah, I feel very at home here.
It would be the kind of place where you would put rushes on the floor still and sweep them out in the spring kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So
that's the perfect lead into going downstairs when after in the 18th century, Elizabeth Bray Allen, who's married to the grandson, Arthur Allen III, comes in.
She makes changes.
She makes major changes right. Downstairs. But going back to the indentured servants up here, who would have been here, it's so 1649, there are only essentially three indentured servants. By 1669, Arthur Allen's recorded with between 11 to 14
wow,
indentured servants.
That's a lot
servants.
Of acreage.
Well, at that point, it's not the addition. Yeah, although he did increase his land holdings, and at one point, Arthur Allen II is noted with some odd 10,000 acres, but that includes land over in Claremont. And
okay, just clarify for me. I'm the Allen family, mm-hmm. and I want more land, so I bring over an indentured servant, and I get my 50 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Only initially.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know what happened. What happens when the indenture is over with? Does the servant then get that 50 acres, or do I keep
no.
it, or what?
So essentially, they would basically just acquire their freedom. As far as we know... out of that 11 to 14 in 1669, only one is basically acquires his freedom. It's after Arthur Allen the first dies that his wife dismisses an indentured servant, Nicholas Seaman. But going forward, there's a larger population in the 17th century of indentured servants on site versus enslaved peoples. It's really not until 1711, when Arthur Allen II dies, that 23 African-American slaves were noted on site. And then, of course, this is in parallel in keeping with what we were talking about with Bacon's Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving forward, the heightened period of slavery was just prior to the Civil War when the Hankins were here. About over 80 mm-hmm. were noted on site. But
And I'd like to interject too that when the Hankins were here, you have upwards of 18 or 19 slave quarters that are on the property. We still have one of those. Mm-hmm. It was constructed in 1829, and it was used all the way into the 20th century. The functions changed. Right. It started out as a one-room slave quarter and then was added onto so that it basically could have held up to four families. So it was basically a two-story duplex.
It's still on site.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot that's on site here, and we haven't even gotten through the house yet. So let's describe the upstairs here so we can look at some other things too.
Okay, so if you're coming up the stairs and then you look to your right, there is one room. It has the original flooring in it. So this is the original 17th century, 1665 flooring.
That's that rough stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And it has a fireplace on this side. And as I mentioned, there are three diagonal fireplaces on one side of the house, and there's three on the other side. So you have a total of six hearths, three on one side, three on the other. So on the west, this is the west side?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So on the west side, you have a fireplace in the garret. You have one on the second floor and one on the first floor. Whereas on this, on the east side of the house, you can see that there isn't a fireplace. And that would be because in the basement, there is an actual full kitchen, and the basement has a kitchen. So the garret doesn't have a fireplace on the other side.
But it has
some
really cool 17th century duct work in there.
Well, you know, we do what we can do.
Well, ladies, I wish we could stay here and do this forever, but I was checking my watch. I think we probably got at least enough for two episodes. No, oh no, not in the least. There's nothing to apologize for. I call it the tyranny of the clock, and indeed it is tyrannical. But before we finish, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share about the rebellion or the castle or about anything at all?
This house being built in 1665 is the oldest brick dwelling in North America.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a constant preservation effort. This house has been remodeled, it's been preserved, and this has happened many times over again. It's a continuous process. But the reason that it's so important that we continue to do that is because it's a place like this that holds the stories that may get glossed over in those history books, but really are the backbone of where we are today. And it's so important that people have the ability to come here to Bacon's Castle to learn about those connections, and so that they're not lost. Because I'm pretty positive that we are the only place where you can hear the story of Bacon's Rebellion.
I suspect that that is true.
Yeah.
And
you get it a little bit at Jamestown, but certainly the only one that continues season long on March through December when we're open on every tour, including Bacon's.
Well, you know, they don't like talking about it in Jamestown because, you know, they lost that one. Okay, that was who likes talking about that? Now, you mentioned something very important, Joanna, and that is that if people want to come here, you're open regularly for between March and December.
Well, we're open on the weekends, Friday, including Friday through Sunday, March through December. In the summer, we are open one extra day on Monday.
So you can plan ahead and come and see Bacon's Castle.
We also have a pretty full event schedule. And so if you like us on Facebook, you'll see all of our events. Or if you go to the preservationvirginia.org website, you'll see a box that has all the events for not only Bacon's Castle, but all of the other historic properties.
They're all over the place in Virginia. I've often commented that if you're going to start a radio show about the Constitution, you need to do it in Virginia. I hadn't even thought about that when I did it. But and we're not far at all from Jamestown. In fact, you know, if you know where Williamsburg is, you go a little bit south of there, you're in Jamestown, you get on the ferry, you cross over here, and you're right here. At the castle.
Yep. Just follow, you know, like John Smith and then the other colonists. You can enjoy the nice scenic ferry ride over.
Which is free. It's a free ferry.
Exactly. It was. All right. Well, thank you, ladies. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jennifer Hurst-Wender and Joanna Braswell of Preservation Virginia. It's a marvelous organization. I urge you to get online, give them tons of money, and then go and visit Bacon's Castle. Heck, go and visit all of their sites. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute, which we didn't have today, but that's okay. Our Madison Minute is done by the incomparable Jim Blaylock, who lives
lives in a house that's actually slightly older than Bacon's castle. You can give him money by visiting his website at preservationblaylock.org. We recently did a show on a controversy in the Goochland County Public Schools, and Sherry Heiter of Bristol, Virginia, corrected my pronunciation. It's not Goochland, it's Goochland. That's Goochland. Thanks, Sherry. You know what? If you get on the internet and you Google your weekly constitutional and you find our podcast, not only can you listen to parts of this episode that you might have missed, you know, when the kids started acting up or when you had to get out of the car, you can do that, and you can also listen to over 150 other archived episodes, and I guarantee there's at least one there that you will love. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.